Today we read from the book of Numbers in the 21st chapter. And as we begin the place in this story, Moses is leading the Israelites through the wilderness, and they have had to set out on a different path to go around the land of Edom. They had not been granted permission to pass through the land of Edom, and so now they're inconvenienced for having to go off of the path to get to this promised destination. And so here we find ourselves in the story on that journey. From Mount Hor, they set out by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom. But the people became impatient on the way. The people spoke against God and against Moses. "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there's no food and no water, and we detest this miserable food." Then the Lord sent poisonous serpents among the people, and they bit the people, so that many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned by speaking against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord to take away the serpents from us." So Moses prayed for the people. And the Lord said to Moses, "Make a poisonous serpent and set it on a pole, and everyone who is bitten shall look at it and live." So Moses made a serpent of bronze and put it on a pole. And whenever a serpent bit someone, that person would look at the serpent of bronze and live. What a text we have for today. This is certainly not one that we teach often in church schools. It's not one that's pictured in children's Bibles. It's likely not one that is well known for you either. For us to really interact with this text, we have to make a promise. We have to promise to not dismiss it as an old school story of an Old Testament God. I hear this phrase a lot, and I admit I've used it myself. When we say the God of the Old Testament, we usually refer to a God who's full of judgment, a God of punishment and fire and sin and brimstone. And inherently, when we use the phrase Old Testament God, we're giving God an adjective. Because we're in essence saying, this God is not the God I claim. This God is different than who I believe God to be and who I experience God. But if we're truthful, the God of the Old Testament is the same God who gifted us with Jesus, God's self-incarnate. This God we worship is one and the same. As difficult as it is to deal with these stories of God letting killer snakes on the loose just to prove a point, it is indeed our God. The God we read about, especially in the book of Numbers, is a God of what they call the priestly tradition. And it is vastly different than the personal relationship we've developed with Jesus, a fellow human who walked in our bodies, dealt with our vulnerabilities, understands our temptations. Jesus gets it. He gets us. We sing about this chummy relationship in many of our hymns. Think of the Easter hymn in the garden, the one that says, "And he walks with me, and he talks with me, and he tells me I am his own. And the joy we have as we tarry there, none other has ever known." Or what about the hymn, "What a Friend We Have in Jesus"? All of these lyrics exemplify the kind of relationship with God that we value. Think of the lyrics of that last hymn. It says, "What a privilege to carry everything to God in prayer." That was not even an option in the priestly tradition. You did not carry things to God in prayer. Only Moses carried things to God in prayer. The common people weren't allowed to. If, as a common person and not a priest, you were to petition God in prayer, there was a certain legalistic formula that you had to follow. There were certain sacrifices that would legitimize your request. And if you didn't follow these, it was utterly offensive to think you could just drop in and ask God for a favor or a blessing. This priestly tradition is the context within which this story of snakes takes place. The text from Numbers is so hard for us to read and hear because we mostly function in what is called the pastoral tradition. My kids received this book for their baptism, and it really exemplifies this pastoral tradition that we are so comfortable with. It's called Every Which Way to Pray. And I know the story really well because my children have learned that if they want an extra story at bedtime, that I'm very likely to agree to it if they pick a story from the children's Bible or a church story. So needless to say, I have this book memorized. This is a book on prayer. And it's a story of these two hippos, Harley and Haley. And the hippos wish they could be close to God, but they feel like they can't. Because as hippos, they can't fly, so they can't be closer to heaven. And they don't know how to pray the right way. See, Harley Hippo thinks that the only way you can pray is if you're in church and dressed up and kneeling and have your head bowed and your eyes closed and your hands folded and you use special words. But throughout the story, they visit these other animals in the zoo. And the hippos learn that you don't have to dress up to pray or fold your hands or bow your head, that you don't have to use special holy words, that you can talk for a long time or pray with just one word. But the important part is you talk to God like you're talking to a friend. You stay in touch. I like the book. I like the premise. I want my kids to approach God like a trusted friend. This book is a great example of how different the priestly tradition functioned. I mean, an informal approach to prayer would have been blasphemous in that tradition. The entire goal of the priestly tradition was to bring together a God who is up there, out there, holy, and a people which were here on earth and were considered common. And the only way to do that was to create some type of holy amidst the common. And so the religious world at that time focused on purification. They focused on the purification of the priesthood, of which Moses and Aaron were a part of, and the purification of the tabernacle, which is the physical dwelling place of worship for that nomadic community. Remember, they were still in this wilderness time, and so they kind of built this mobile church, so to speak, where they kept these tablets. It was called the tabernacle. And so in this way, to focus on how to purify the tabernacle and how to purify the priests, the idea was that they could somehow make the common hospitable enough for the holy to dwell in. And so the priestly tradition was characterized by this deep chasm between God and the people. And that chasm could only be crossed in very prescriptive ways and only by certain people. The challenge for us, having lived in and lived with an understanding of God as a friend, from living in that pastoral tradition much of our lives, is that we have to figure out how to suspend judgment on how spirituality was developing at that chapter of our history. Because, friends, if we read this story today from our pastoral lens, it is horrifying. If we seek, however, to understand it from the priestly tradition under which our ancestors were living, if we see it through that lens, we see a God who responds to common people's complaints, even though they didn't follow the prescribed prayer plans. We see a God who punishes, yes, but who is responsive to their needs, and whose punishment isn't permanent. And so as we dive into the teaching of this text, we do so in the priestly tradition which it was first written. But before we get into the snake and the bite, I want to talk a bit about snakes in general, because snakes were this deeply divine symbol throughout not only our Judeo-Christian scriptures, but throughout various religious traditions in the ancient Near East. Snakes are a bit like fire. They have this double agent of life and death, healing and destruction. Fire, while it can certainly be deadly and destructive, also has an ability to refine. If you need to use a needle to work out a sliver out of your skin in your hand, what are you going to do with the needle first? Hopefully, put it through fire and sterilize it, right? Fire can function to purify or to destroy. And snakes are the same way. Snakes, while certainly deadly, were also seen as purifying and protective agents. The prophet Isaiah from our scriptures was purified to begin his ministry by this winged seraph in the form of a snake. Pharaoh depended on the snake's protective nature. In fact, we have historical depictions of the Pharaoh's headdress, and on it there was the goddess Wadjet, who happened to be a cobra. And it was thought that Wadjet would spit poisonous venom on king's enemies in order to help protect the leader. This double agency of a snake's ability to destroy and protect is obvious. And here in the story in Numbers, the double function of the snake is also obvious. But the lesson for us, the message, the reason we preach on this, is that we are invited to really examine what is required to switch the snake from kill mode to healing mode. And according to the text, two things are required for this to happen. The first is obedience from our leader, Moses, and the second is the gaze from the affected Israelites. So let's start with the obedience of Moses. Moses prays to God for the people. That's what the text says. That's his priestly duty. That's within that tradition. But it's important to note that Moses prayed for the people probably a bit more begrudgingly than the initial reading might suppose. See, these people had been complaining a great deal lately. It's as if they'd prefer the slavery and oppression of Egypt to the discomforts and liberation of the wilderness. If Moses could have done what I had done the other day with my children in the car and said, "If you do not stop fighting, I will stop this car and turn it around," he probably would have. See, just a couple chapters ago, the people were complaining to God about not having enough water to drink. Moses thought their complaint was an actual petition prayer to God, which would have broken those ritualistic laws that were required for the common people to go to God in prayer. And so he responds to them. He gives them water, but he chastises them, and he calls them rebels. And between that story and this story, Moses' brother Aaron, who had helped him in leading this group of complaining Israelites as a fellow priest, Aaron had died. And so now Moses has his nephew under his wing to train in priesthood, and he's grieving and he's overwhelmed, and the Israelites are complaining again. As the text tells us, God sent snakes as a punishment for their grumbling. Moses once again has to intervene for their welfare. So yes, he is obedient, but he is likely obedient with a level of begrudging. Next, Moses follows to a T the directions that God leaves. He said, "Build a serpent out of bronze. Put it on a pole or banner and instruct that when those inflicted with a snake bite lift their eyes and gaze upon this bronze serpent, that they will be healed." When I first read this, I thought, sounds really idolatrous to me. Generally, in the Old Testament, when you build some type of animal out of metal and have some type of cult worship function for it, it doesn't bode well for the people, and God is not a very happy camper. But here, God himself is instructing the making of this bronze serpent. And so it is not an act of idolatry, but rather an act of obedience. And Moses passes this test with flying colors. The next requirement to fully move the switch of the snake's function from kill to heal is the response of the people inflicted. They must choose to believe and to trust in the antidote God has provided. They must lift their eyes up to the gaze of the bronze serpent and receive the gift of healing and of life. There is so much humanity happening in this act. This speaks of obedience and faith. It speaks of repentance and a recognition of one's own wrongdoing. It furthermore speaks of a desire to leave that way of wrongdoing and try a different way, lifting up your eyes to see a new way forward. It's a beautiful human story, and one we can all connect with, despite how it might read on the surface. Because who among us have never complained when in reality we are blessed beyond our wildest dreams? Who among us hasn't fallen short, either by our actions or inactions, by our self-absorption or self-indulgence? Who here hasn't created their own ground covering of snakes because of what we did or didn't do? We have all been where these Israelites are. We have all been bitten by these snakes. I have a friend whose goddaughter is in the third grade and whose parents put her in violin lessons. She hates practicing, and so she doesn't. And yet she continues to go to the lessons week in and week out. She was prodded to preview her recital piece by my friend, and she performed rather poorly. My friend also plays violin, so she gave her some pointers. She encouraged her to log 10 minutes of practice each day before the recital. It would have been 1 week. But the little girl did not heed the advice, and when the time came for her recital, it was a total train wreck. She was devastated. She was embarrassed. She left the stage with tears in her eyes, and her parents wanted to rescue her from her disappointment. And so they called my friend and they said, "Hey, can you take out our little girl and comfort her and tell her that this happens to the best of violin performers. Just tell her it'll go better next time. And my friend said, are you kidding me? I mean, I'll take her out. I'll talk to her about how she's still loved. But she played like that because she chose not to practice or prepare. So to tell her that those actions will result in a good performance the next time around is misleading. And she didn't want to shame the kid, but she wanted her to own her own mistakes and her decisions so that she could make better decisions the next time around. You know, as a parent, I can see this predicament. I want to rescue my kids from the snakes they create for themselves all the time. I can't stand to watch their disappointment or their suffering, even when that disappointment and suffering is based on their own disobedience or their own bad decisions. But I also support my friend's view. We have to teach our kids that their decisions have consequences. And that can be done lovingly, and she did. She talked to the young girl about why she decided not to practice, and she communicated that she loved her despite how she performed. But if she wanted different results, then she needed to change her game plan. The Israelites kept complaining and grumbling and griping about a liberated life that was gifted to them. And it wasn't as if this was the first time they complained. It was about the 110th. Their lack of gratitude and their inability to see the good created for them an experience of snakes. And whether you want to take this story literally or not is, of course, up to you. But for me, I don't see this as literal cobras biting the most bitter of complainers. I do see this story as our human tendency to make our bed and then act dismayed when we're asked to lie in it. No one likes punishment. No one likes to feel disappointment. No one likes the experience of the snake bite. The point of this story is that the snake can offer healing. The point is that it doesn't end with a fatal bite. It ends with a gaze up. God offers the antidote, and the antidote is still the snake. It's as if part of the solution is remembering how it is that we got to that experience of the snake bite to begin with. I mean, think about it. The antidote could have been any bronze animal, right? Could have been a goat or sheep or maybe a caricature of Moses' face placed on a pole. But no, it was another snake, and that's significant. I wonder if there's healing power in the memory of the mistake. We're invited to learn from it, but not to perish from it. We're invited to lift our eyes, not to keep our heads hung in downcast shame, but to lift them, raise our eyes and our gaze and our focus to the next big step, to the way to do it better next time. And the people who had experienced the snake bite choose the antidote. They choose to look their mistake in the eye, see the error of their ways, and take God's hand as they journey forward to try it again. God keeps that gaze up. I didn't end the reading early. They are not required to do any further act of penance. They simply gaze upon the serpent and live. How freeing is that? For God of the Old Testament, this sounds a lot like forgiveness. It sounds like a new beginning and a second chance. This story was so significant to the experience of humanity and the relationship with God that this bronze serpent had a significant place within the Jerusalem temple. It even had a name. They called it Nehushtan, and it still functioned in cultic ritual ways in the temple. And we know because it was one of the items that was listed as being destroyed during a war later in the book of 2 Kings. Even Jesus knew this story well. He referred to it in the Gospel of John in the verses that lead right up to the infamous John 3:16 line. In verses 14 and 15, he says, "Just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him may have eternal life." Moses lifting up this serpent in the wilderness is a story of choosing life through a recognition of what it was that made us experience death. We look it in the eyes, the past of our mistakes, and the promise of a different future. God invites us to experience this gaze, to learn the lesson, to continue the journey, and to live again. So beware of the snake bite indeed. Beware of how our own words and actions, silence and inactions, can create destruction for us and for others. But be aware. Be aware of the serpent that invites us to lift our eyes and meet the gaze of God, a gaze that calls us to a second chance, a gaze that calls us to life. Thanks be to the God whom we lift our eyes. Amen. Sorry, I still can't say beware of the snake bite. I screwed it up every single time I said it.